It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, drones. Imagine a world where flying robots watch over our borders, help search and rescue missions, survey roads and pipelines. That may sound like science fiction, but in fact, it's already happening. And there's more. Amazon's trying to test a fleet of delivery drones. And Martha Stewart says she's in love with her new drone camera. So today, we'll talk about how drones could change everything from shopping to military combat.
1 minute, you're totally immersed in a war environment. And the next minute, you drive home and somebody's upset at you because your pickup truck leaked oil in the driveway.
We'll hear stories from one of the guys behind the U.S. drone missions in Afghanistan and Iraq. But first, the scary version of our drone future.
Every night on drones, we take you live to the front lines. Where high-tech heroes use cutting-edge technology and blow the hell out of the bad guys.
That's a scene from Alex Rivera's film Sleep Dealer, a sci-fi thriller set in Mexico in a very dystopian future. In it, the border has been sealed tight and is policed by military drones. Migrant workers cross over virtually by plugging their bodies into a digital network of robots. Sleep Dealer came out in 2008. It was a cult hit that for a long time was hard to find, and it's just now available online. Steve Paulson caught up with Alex Rivera to talk about the symbolism of drones.
Alex, why are you so fascinated by drones, both as new technology and metaphor?
To me, you know, I consider drones in a sense the kind of metaphor or the meme of our time. I think of drones as a reflection of many other aspects of the world we're living in right now, of our contemporary reality. My interest in drones started in a kind of strange way through my interest in immigration. For many years, I've been involved in telling stories and making films about immigrant life in America. And the image of the undocumented person as a person who's here physically but not here necessarily legally, right, that this kind of sense of being and unbeing, to me, started me thinking about cyberspace, about digitality, about telepresence, about this idea of being somewhere where you're also not.
So it's this fascination with drones has to do with things happening across both space and time. And of course, the idea of the drone is that it's this remote controlled machine usually that's being operated somewhere else, and then it goes off and does its business, and sometimes in some very faraway places.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think in its core, you know, I've been interested in the drone because it's in a sense the most intense or this kind of crystallization of these transnational dynamics that surround us in many, many ways, whether it's call centers in India, whether it's our system of factories that our economies created that wrap around the globe, whether it's systems of migration of people who come from around the globe here to take care of our kids or to change bedsheets in a hotel. I mean, there's this kind of matrix that destroys borders all around the world, all these kinds of exchanges that we're involved in every day. But to me, the drone is the most intense and kind of visceral of those exchanges. And that's why, for me, it is the metaphor or the kind of meme of our time.
And it would seem that drone technology is just starting to be developed. I mean, we tend to hear about the military uses, but apparently in the commercial sector, drones are just starting to emerge as something very big.
The drone now is an integrated part of America's border security apparatus to hunt for border crossers, whether they be smugglers or families, whatever it is. But the drone is now part of America's border architecture. 10 years ago, the drone was in Yemen, in Pakistan, Afghanistan, etc. Now it's in Laredo, El Paso, Nogales. The drone is coming home.
Now, and what you've said is it's as a surveillance tool, obviously, it's incredibly powerful. Are there other areas where drones are starting to infiltrate daily life?
Sure. Well, beyond surveillance, the drone is starting to be discussed as a way of creating other types of efficiencies in the economy. Like I heard recently, they're talking about cargo plane drones being used for FedEx, or, you know, drones that mimic the flight of hummingbirds or down to bumblebees. There's a lot of research right now into creating drone bumblebees to replace organic bees because the bees are disappearing, hives are collapsing, and our food supply depends on them. And so there's a big investment right now in creating mechanical bees that could move the pollen around, that could do the work of organic bees in case the organic ones take off.
Wow. I mean, this is sort of scary, I guess, to me. Maybe I'm just a Luddite or something, but the idea of machines replacing bees, replacing this, you know, living organic creature.
And I think that's happening across the spectrum. Like, it's fascinating to think about drones replacing bumblebees. It's fascinating in a different way to think about drones replacing our family or our friends and their jobs, you know. And I think this kind of concept of these machines replacing or taking the place of humans in all of these different types of activity is a troubling and sort of fascinating notion. Like, where do we go once you have a car that drives itself? Where do all the car drivers go? Where do the truck drivers go? What do they do?
Well, you are an artist. I mean, you are a filmmaker. So as an artist, what do you do with this? I mean, how do you think about, how do you make art out of this whole new technology of drones?
Well, it's I think in terms of making art about this, it's beguiling. It's hard to figure out where to get your hook in and where to intervene, you know? For me, I've done a few projects. In 2005, I was invited to do a piece of border art in this border arts festival. And so what we did is we wanted to make a drone that instead of surveilling the border, instead of casting fear down below it, a drone that would cast joy, or a drone that would be playful.
A happy drone.
A drone that instead of enforcing the border would delete the border. And so we built a drone that we called the Low Drone. We kind of deployed these urban Latino aesthetics of the low rider. So we built the drone that was spectacular. Gold flake paint, custom chrome, and launched it from Mexico over the border to the U.S. And it kind of hopped back and forth, spun it around in the air. The Border Patrol came over to look at it. They had their masks on, but underneath their mask, I could see they were jealous because their paint jobs are very drab, and our paint job was awesome.
That is hilarious. Now, you've also made a film, Sleep Dealer, which deals, again, with border issues. Tell us, what's the basic plot of your film?
So in 1997, I was watching two things happen. One was the development of the internet and a whole bunch of new metaphors. And one of the metaphors that caught my attention was telecommuting. And then the other thing I was watching was the development of the border. Strangely, at the same time that the internet was being established, it built up, and creating a global village. And it was a strange moment to me because I was looking at the internet erasing borders, but then borders being erected on the ground. And listening to internet culture, there was this dialogue about telecommuting, how we'll all eventually work from home. Coming from an immigrant family, I started to think, well, what if we worked from home? And home in my family's case being Peru, coming to the U.S. to work, maybe we would telecommute in some near future and somehow control from Latin America, control machines that did the labor in the U.S. cross that border that way and send pure labor without the body.
So in your film, you have these people who go into this work center in Tijuana, this border city, and they basically go into a computer center and they control remote-controlled robots somewhere in the United States.
Yep. The main character in Sleep Dealer is a young man named Memo Cruz from southern Mexico, who today would be a border crosser who would come here to work. In this future, the border is sealed, so he can't come to the U.S. But there's another innovation in this future, which is instead of physically coming to the U.S., he ends up in a factory in Mexico where he connects his body to a kind of high-speed internet and controls a machine that does his labor in America. So he, in a sense, telecommutes across the border. His body stays in Mexico, but he realizes his labor in the U.S. And in this strange, brave new border world, he's not alone. There are other characters. And the antagonist is a drone pilot, someone who's in the U.S. physically, and he controls drones that are going all around the world. So he's a kind of mirror image of the main character. The main character is in Mexico working remotely in the U.S. The drone pilot is in the U.S. working kind of remotely around the world through these killer machines. And So it's a science fiction film that tries to reflect on all of these different ways in which we're connected and alienated.
And there's a very sinister element to this story as well, that if people are starting to appear at least to make trouble in Mexico, you know, that who object to this system, drones as weapons will be sent to destroy them.
and broadcast on reality TV to high ratings, which again, this is barely science fiction.
So we've been talking about all of this drones as this new technology being used by the military, being sort of creeping into the commercial sector. It all sounds pretty scary, I have to say. I mean, yes, there are efficiencies here, but is there anything good about drones?
What's good about drones to me is what it helps us see what's happening. You know, it's the first military technology since maybe the nuclear bomb that becomes kind of like something that the whole culture is wrapped around or reflecting on or thinking about, right? The nuclear era, which I grew up in, was something that was very productive for artists, for social movements, for critics, because we could see it and think about it and say, is this what we want? You know, it was like this crystallization of the Cold War is the nuclear bomb. That's the thing that lets us reflect on the historical moment. And I think right now the drone is that. And so I'm kind of grateful to it for being this kind of, you know, grotesque little creature that we can at least discuss and reflect on, you know, and that's helpful.
Alex Rivera is the co-writer and director of the film Sleep Dealer. You can see the trailer on our website at ttbook.org. Next, an unlikely advocate for pilotless drones. Missy Cummings spent years landing F-18 fighter jets for the U.S. Navy, but these days she studies unmanned systems like drones. She's director of Duke University's Humans and Autonomy Lab. That's HAL for all you 2001 Space Odyssey fans. Charles Monroe Kane talked with Missy about a few of the ways drones are being used outside the military and about how someone who used to fly the real thing fell in love with drones.
Around 1994, I transitioned to the F-18 Hornet, which is a computer-controlled aircraft. And I was blown away. The airplane at that time could land itself just fine on the aircraft carrier. And worse was you weren't even allowed to touch anything on takeoff. You actually had to show that your hands were not touching anything inside the aircraft before they would shoot you off the carrier, because if a pilot touched anything inside the aircraft, they would only screw it up. So I think, you know, that really started to make me wonder about the future and why was I actually in the cockpit in the first place if the plane could do it almost all by itself.
You know, Missy, I grew up really working class, and I can just picture my uncle or my father really not liking this new technology and how it works. Do you feel like this transition was a good thing, or do you feel it was inevitable?
You know, there's a little bit of both of that. I also come from a very blue-collar world, kind of a agriculture farming environment. But, you know, I saw it very quickly because so many of my friends were dying. Being in that inside that environment, watching people die, understanding just how quickly the automation was advancing, it really did help push me down the path of research. And I was one of the early researchers in unmanned aerial vehicles, which we commonly refer to as drones now. And I will tell you that I'm amazed at the rapid pace of the commercial development. I thought we would be this where we are today is where we would be in 5 to 10 years. And so I'm really impressed with the global response to the commercial capabilities of these aircraft.
Well, where are we today? I mean, outside of the military, how else are drones being used?
Well, I think it's important to stipulate that there are ways that it's being used in other parts of the world and the ways that we want to use them inside of the United States. So, for example, Japan has been using drones to do their crop dusting for over 20 years. In fact, the bulk of their crop dusting is now done by these flying robots. And we recognize in this country that we want to do that and we need to do that. That's, in fact, one of the most dangerous jobs of general aviation, lots of crashes and deaths. So we need to get that person out of the cockpit, but the FAA regulations right now prohibit that. Other uses are first response, search and rescue. There was a case recently in Wisconsin where an older gentleman was lost for 3 days and they couldn't find him. And then a guy popped up a drone and within 20 minutes they were able to locate him and save his life.
Amazing.
And so local law enforcement agencies around the country are desperate to get this technology because it's phenomenally cheaper, orders of magnitude cheaper than flying manned aircraft. And so ultimately it's a savings to the taxpayer, but also an improvement in safety and efficiency. And so we're still struggling. And then, of course, the cargo world. There are companies that are putting vaccination delivery together in Africa, for example. But even in this country, not in this country, although it's part of a U.S. military program, there were a couple of drone helicopters over in Afghanistan, the K-MAX, that these two little helicopters trucked around over 3 million pounds of goods.
Wow.
Back and forth. And it saved countless lives because it took the convoy trucks off the roads and out of the way of IEDs. And so those kinds of cargo missions, I think, will be up and coming. But I can guarantee you that all the large cargo aircraft, FedEx, DHL, UPS, are going to be looking at how to actually turn their aircraft into drones. They're the next big wave of large aircraft drones.
You know, for most Americans, there's an 800-pound elephant in the room that we're not talking about, and that is privacy. And I thought about this the other day. Have you wrapped your head around privacy and drones and just them taking pictures of us everywhere?
Drones do take pictures. Many drones actually navigate and stabilize through pictures that they take of the ground. And so it is true that these are moving cameras through the world. But what it's hard to conceive of is that the actual field of view of these cameras is very small. And it's not like you have a big camera that's taking huge, you know, pictures of huge tracts of land, and then we're able to pinpoint anything out of those pictures. The pictures are there, and whether or not they're recorded, it really depends on the system. And so I do think that it potentially drones who have cameras on board potentially could violate your privacy, which is why local and state legislatures, as well as the federal government, need to step in. So, you know, for example, if you've got a drone doing, let's say it's an Amazon drone that's using cameras to help navigate. So what they will do, we need some policies like, okay, the cameras, whatever recordings we take, are going to be held for 48 hours after a flight, and then they're going to be destroyed, for example. And so I think that if people understood that this is just part of the way that the drones have to operate and that we are going to protect your data, I think once people understood that, they would be more accepting of the technology. But the FAA's current policy of just not addressing it at all, or state legislatures that just ban all drones, are actually doing much more harm than good, because they only feed into that paranoia and fear and don't actually do anything proactive to address the situation. And in fact, they hamper what is otherwise a booming economy elsewhere.
Well, also, I was thinking about that when you're speaking about the FAA. I mean, what are the regulations around just airspace, not just privacy? Simple thing as airspace.
Right. And this is actually the catch-22 of what the FAA currently has in place. Right now, you, as just an average person, can go out and fly a drone as long as you stay below 400 feet and out of populated areas. But there's no requirements of training. There's no requirements of certification. Me, as a researcher who's been doing drone research for over 10 years, I am not allowed to go out and fly under those same conditions that you are to conduct research to find out how to better design ground control stations without going through an arduous certification and authorization process through the FAA that may or may not be approved. And so what we have in the world right now in this country is we have basically a bunch of hobbyists and people who really don't know anything about drones who are able to fly, you know, in these unrestricted airspace areas, whereas people who know what they're doing are not allowed to. And that's important because companies are not allowed to go out and do not even commercial operations, but they can't even do test and evaluation like they need to figure out what the operations would look like.
Missy, could you daydream for me for a moment here as we end? Like, maybe shut your eyes and tell me if 25 years from now, 50 years from now, where will drones be in our lives?
They will be your flying car. You know, this is the dream. We've got the driverless car that's coming up basically at the same time as the commercial advancement of drones. And one day, Zipcar and Google and Terra Fuego, that's a rotable aircraft company, are all going to get together and we're going to have this amazing flying car.
Can I ask you a personal question? You've flown the Hornet, and before that you've flown the fully manned aircraft, and now you're certainly, I guess, piloting drones. What about the fun difference? I mean, you must love flying, right? You're a serious pilot. Yeah. Is it any fun to be a part of doing drones?
It's a great question because, you know, when I do this environment, you know, when I'm in this environment, I kind of have this, heh, heh, heh. At least I got mine, you know. At least I got to fly.
I got to fly high.
You I did. But I have to tell you, when I was in my 20s, I was in the military. I was in the Philippines. I was flying A-4s, and we were out of control. We were flying low. We were dangerous. And, boy, did I tell you, I have my hair on fire, and it's given me a lot of my chutzpah and confidence that I have as an adult now. And I have to tell you, it was amazingly fun, but we were also amazingly unsafe. And aircraft now are so expensive. You know, the F-18 that I flew was about $60 million, and that was not including any weapons. And so, you know, we just can't take those chances anymore. Although I will tell you, my students have fun flying it, but I don't think that they could ever know what it's like to go, you know, 25 feet over the ground, kicking up a rooster tail, going along down inside of a trench, inside of a volcanic area. It's pretty fun.
That does sound like fun. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Missy Cummings directs the Humans and Autonomy Lab at Duke University. She talked with Charles Monroe Kane. Coming up, a former U.S. Air Force drone operator takes us inside his world, piloting unmanned missions in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. We're talking about drones in this hour, and maybe you've heard that Amazon wants to develop a fleet of delivery drones. Apparently, 2 days shipping isn't fast enough for some people. Drones could cut delivery time down to just half an hour. Amazon's serious about this. The company's even asked the FAA for permission to test out the concept. So what would that look like? Listener Sandra Chisti gives us a glimpse in her short story called Drones Gone Wild.
The delivery drones went rogue on December 26th. Maybe it was all the overload from holiday gifts, returns, and exchanges. Maybe it was a computer virus, or maybe it was just technology developed too fast and too cheap, used by too many people. I called up a drone to return a very unique and hideous Christmas sweater my Aunt Melinda gave me. I love my aunt, but sometimes she still thinks of me as a 5-year-old. The drone arrived, on time, at 6 p.m., but with a delivery. Just about everything I bought was delivered by drones, so I took the package, opened it, kind of confused. It was an assault rifle, with a laser scope and ammunition clips. The drone hovered outside my door, its delivery confirmation button glowing.
Please confirm delivery.
I didn't order this. I ordered a pickup, not a delivery.
Please confirm delivery.
It seemed angry. It was kind of nuts. I didn't order this. I ordered a pickup for return. Clutching the rifle and accessories with one arm, I held up the sweater in the clear plastic return package. The drone swiveled toward the sweater.
Gross.
Excuse me? I just want to return it. I don't want this either. It's a mistake. I was still clutching the rifle against my chest.
Please confirm delivery. You have 15 seconds before you are categorized as uncooperative.
What?
10, 9, 8.
There were shouts down the street. I looked and saw the evening sky was full of drones. Some were from the local drugstore, others from fast food places. Most of them were the cheap, unmarked generic drones, like the one hovering on my porch. A scream came from two houses down. I turned back to the delivery drone, and a flexible tube was emerging from underneath it. A red light glowed at the hollow end. I looked down at my shirt. A laser target glared over my heart.
5, 4, 3...
Wait, whoa, is this some kind of joke? I dropped the sweater and pressed the confirm delivery button.
2, 1...
I pressed the button again, squinting, clutching the rifle.
Delivery confirmed. Thank you for using Drones Unlimited.
It spun away and got lost among the other drones above my neighborhood. I shut the door, locked it. I turned on the TV, but only got the static network logos. Then the lights flickered, they dimmed, and went out. I went to the front window and looked outside. The entire street was dark, except for the whirling lights of delivery drones. A neighbor ran down the street, holding up a rake to fight off a drone that was chasing him. The drone backed off, but then another one came at him from the side. I turned away from the window, closed the curtains, and stumbled into the dark kitchen. I dug through the junk drawer and found a flashlight and sat on the floor to read the instruction manual that came with the rifle.
Drones Gone Wild. Our story was written by listener Sandra Chisti and performed by Sarah Nix and Doug Gordon, with sound design by Brittany True. And now we'll turn to the first thing that comes to mind about drones, their military use in combat missions around the world. Bruce Black is a retired U.S. Air Force drone pilot, and over the course of several years, he logged more than 1,500 hours flying drones in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. The surreal part is that he piloted many of those missions out of Creech Air Force Base, about 35 miles north of Las Vegas.
It is very strange. You get up in the morning and kiss your family goodbye and drive off. And the next thing you know, I mean, as soon as you step into the squadron, you're on a war footing. Being in the box is a very immersive environment. It's like you're actually there. You're hearing the bullets whiz over the guys' heads. You are hearing the stress in their voices. You're hearing the need for the support that you are providing. And then you would debrief after your missions, and you'd get in your car and you'd drive home, and all of a sudden you're back in a civilian environment. One minute you're totally immersed in a war environment. Life and death, the decisions are hinging on what you say and you do. And the next minute you drive home and somebody's upset at you because your pickup truck leaked oil in the driveway.
So what did you and your fellow pilots do to help make that transition, to prevent your two worlds from seeping into each other?
Well, I don't know, maybe it's a male trait of being able to compartmentalize. You get fairly good at it. This is my combat life. This is my private life. Do they interact sometimes? Yes. Do you carry the stress home with you? Yes. But there was no particular routine that I had ever heard anybody develop that helped them make that transition. You're just kind of expected to do that.
Yeah, it's part of the job. So tell me about some of the missions you carried out. Were they mostly about surveillance?
Most of it was surveillance. 99% of what we did was trying to figure out what was going on, where people were, where assets were, so that I could send that data off and the ground troops could take care of that. That was 99% of our job.
What can you see and how well can you see it? I mean, how good is the resolution?
It's extremely good. Some of the cameras, depending on which aircraft you're flying, are HD. I could tell you whether somebody was holding up four fingers or five fingers.
Wow.
At times. Yes, the resolution's that good. It's dependent on how far away you are from the subject.
So you must have felt, if you were following people, you must have felt like you really got to know them.
You spend a lot of time doing that. And yes, you want to be very sure of your target. For example, when we actioned Zarqawi, we took out Zarqawi, we flew 600 hours on him to track him, figure out where he was, figure out the compound he was in, who was in the compound with him, so that when they struck that compound, there was as few people that were going to get hurt as possible. And we actually delayed the strike on that compound because there were some people in there that they didn't want to hurt. And they knew Zarqawi wasn't going to move from there.
Now, when a strike is called, one of the things that must be really different from being on the ground is that a fighter pilot drops his bomb and leaves, but a drone sticks around, right?
Yes. The typical Predator mission was 20 hours. let's say you were going to actually do a strike that day, that aircraft may be following that target for 18 hours prior to that point. And then you're going to strike the target, and then you stick around and watch afterwards to see what the effects were. And that has a lot of different aspects to it. But one of them is that you're very sure of what you're striking, and you're very sure of the battle damage afterwards. And that's a big help as far as military planning goes.
Well, it must be personally pretty difficult. I mean, how much do you see of the aftermath?
A lot.
So it must be hard.
It is.
I don't know. How do you deal with that?
Everybody deals with it differently. I would have a very visceral, guttural reaction to some of that. And then some of it, you're just mad because they're shooting at people that you care about. And everybody's different. Everybody has a different level. But I think if you were to ask your average crew after a strike and you get them away from each other and away from the bravado of being in the squadron, it's a very strange feeling. For me, it's a rather sickening feeling. But you do what you need to do to support the people that are counting on you.
See, this is the thing that I think the public, at least, tends to worry, that you put guys behind drones, have them pilot drones, and the bloodshed and the killing won't feel real. You know, that it'll all just be some remote thing, and we're killing people across the world, and it's all just like a big video game. But from what you're saying, it sounds like that's not at all the case.
I would vehemently disagree with that assessment. I would say it is more real to me than your average fast mover, meaning a jet fighter, that shows up, has 15 minutes to drop his ordnance, and then get back to a tanker. I watched him for a day, 7 days, a month. We finally struck him, and then I watched the aftermath of it and had to have my crew describe how it went. It was much more real to me than what I would expect a fighter pilot to have seen and done.
Hmm. Yeah, that reminds me of some of the recent reports that have found drone pilots are susceptible, very susceptible to PTSD, as much so as ground troops. Is that something you and your squad talk about?
We talk about it in the very early days of flying drones. I don't think they were as much worried about it. And then some instances started cropping up. I don't think we have a higher rate than the rest of the communities. One of the doctors that I had talked to when I was in the squadron, he said he wouldn't call it PTSD. It's something else. But there was a stressor that was showing itself in that community and that they were concerned about it.
I'm curious, I'd love to know more about your missions. I know there's probably a limit to what you can tell us, but I don't know, what missions are you proudest of?
My proudest moment was, I thought the mission that day was going to be extremely boring. My portion of it was 4 hours of watching the aircraft do circles in the air. About halfway through my shift, a new sensor operator comes into the box, and he sat down in the seat, and he goes, "Hey, Colonel Black, hi, I'm Sergeant Kim." And it's my first mission off of Mission Qual. And he sits down in the seat, and I said, "Don't worry about it. It's going to be easy. You know, we're just doing circles today." Right after he sits down, we get a tip that something was happening in this particular sector, and they asked us to take a look at it. So we swing the ball over, and we take a look at it, and there's two guys digging in the ground. Well, it was 2 o'clock in the morning in Baghdad. Nobody's fixing their plumbing at 2 o'clock in the morning in Baghdad. And then as we sit and watch it, we start seeing there's a couple of wires trailing off from where they're digging going to another house. And so we say, okay, this is suspicious. We need to get a JTAC on there, which is a joint air attack controller. So we finally get somebody on there, and we're getting ready to strike this position. And all of a sudden comes into the picture this convoy of big trucks. And it's like, oh, my God, these guys are going to drive right over the top of it. So I tell my sensor operator, I says, "Fire on the truck." And what I wanted him to do was just turn his laser on and point it at the truck and fire. And he goes, "Sir, you want to blow up the truck?" And I go, no. "Put your laser designator on him." And what everybody there in country knows, that if this beam comes out of the sky and it's flashing right on you or right in front of your truck, stop. Don't move. So we put our tracker in front of him and we start flashing it and everything stops. And I saved, if I didn't save that convoy, I saved somebody in the next one. And that's my proudest moment.
Wow. That's quite a first day for the kid sitting next to you.
Exactly. His first day, his first combat, and he's just saved a bunch of people. You know, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful thing.
Now, it's so interesting because in that story also, there's the other thing that people worry about, which is the potential for civilian deaths. I mean, you had to decide, you know, and not you alone, but you all had to decide that these two people who were digging were definitely worth killing.
And it took us about an hour, maybe two, I can't remember the length of time, but to figure out that that was not just somebody fixing their plumbing. And that's the beauty of drones.
So what do you make then of, I mean, a lot of human rights groups have raised concerns about the toll drones have taken on civilian populations. I think there was a report earlier this year found that hundreds of civilians were killed in drone strikes in Pakistan alone in the past 5 years.
Well, I'm a natural skeptic of some of that. Do civilian casualties happen? Yes, they happen in all wars. War is a horrible thing, and that's one of the calculuses that has to be made by the leadership when they decide to engage is, are you willing to pay the price for what you are about to do politically, morally, ethically, and if you believe in a God, to your God someday, are you willing to take that price? As I say, I'm a skeptic of some of Amnesty International's reporting at the time. For example, there was one report about a lady that was blown up by a drone strike, but they had no evidence of that. And I myself watched civilians get blown up because they happened to be walking in the wrong place and a bomb went off that a bomb in placer had not planned on. He was trying to get a blue force and he ended up blowing up a sheep herder. So I don't know their evidence. I haven't seen it, and I don't think they have bothered to publish any of that either.
Do you think drones are the future of war?
Yes. But again, I have to caution the point. I mean, a lot of people talk about drones, and everybody thinks drones, it's unmanned. It's just doing it automatically. For every drone, every predator that flew, it took 175 people to make that happen for a 24-hour shift. On the Global Hawk, it takes 450 people to make that happen.
I'm curious. I mean, right now, the U.S. has the advantage because we're flying drones against an enemy that doesn't have any. But if drones are going to be the future of warfare, that's not always going to be the case. I mean, what will happen when drones are much more common, when the enemy you're flying against has drones?
And that's what we need to be prepared for. We need to be moving forward on how to counter that. And they're already there. I think you heard the reports about Hamas launching a drone against Israel. That's new, and it's coming. Everybody can see the effectiveness.
Well, Bruce, thank you for your service, and thank you so much for telling us about it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you.
Bruce Black is a retired U.S. Air Force drone pilot. And that's it for our talk about drones. When we come back, internet poet Steve Rogenbuck shares a bookmark. And we talk to Afghan-American writer Nadia Hashimi about her debut novel, The Pearl That Broke Its Shell. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Steve Rogenbuck. I'm a poet on the internet, and I want to recommend Feminism is for Everybody by Bell Hooks. Bell Hooks is just one of my favorite writers because she's so clear and so kind and yet so relentless in her criticisms and, like, her integrity. So Bell Hooks has this very revolutionary set of ideas, you know, that when she talks about feminism, she's not just talking about feminism in the sense that a lot of people understand it, like equal pay for women. She's also talking about class oppression and race and sexual orientation. And she's also criticizing oftentimes the way our capitalist system works and the way our sort of imperialist relation with other countries works. So her critique is really revolutionary and broad, and yet she's always so balanced and, like, I feel like I trust her voice that she's writing with. Bell Hooks has this sense of balance and calm and directness in her voice that even if I wasn't passionate about the content, I would still be interested just to read her talking about anything because the way she talks is so direct and sincere, and it kind of has a little bit of warmth, but it doesn't sacrifice any of the precision or integrity to have that warmth. Feminism is for Everybody is a great introduction to Bell Hooks and a great introduction to feminism because she basically wanted it to be the book that you could give to somebody when they're like, I don't understand feminism, or they're spouting off an idea of feminism which is obviously clearly misinformed. So it's a very broad overview of what feminism is or could be, and it addresses, like, all these different issues, like the ways that feminism interacts with all these different systems and practices in our society, and sort of helps you get a more holistic view of the vision. And I really appreciate how clearly Bell Hooks lays it out that feminism is not anti-male, it's anti-sexism. That scares so many people off from engaging with feminism, as they think it's like anti-male. And people say, I'm not feminist, I just think everybody should be equal. But that's what feminism is. It's that everybody should be equal. And so, like, to be feminist is to be against sexism, not to be against males. And that it's important for males to be feminists and to engage with feminist ideas too. And so it's very important to me as a male that she acknowledges that right up front and, like, includes me in the discussion and, like, trust that even if I may have some internalized sexism, that I can be part of this movement and I can help.
Internet poet Steve Rogenbuck with his recommendation, Feminism is for Everybody by Bell Hooks. You'll find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, we've just finished reading a first novel from Afghan-American writer Nadia Hashimi. It's called The Pearl That Broke Its Shell, and it tells the interwoven stories of two Afghan women, a girl named Rahima and her great-great-grandmother. And for different reasons, they each adopt an ancient Afghan custom called Bacha Posh, in which a girl is allowed to dress as a boy. Sarah Nix asked Nadia why she chose to tell both women's tales.
You know, any family that you come from, you identify with your ancestors, you draw from their experiences, and you draw from who they were. So it's very important in Afghan society where you came from and who you came from. And for my character, Rahima, she looks back to the story of her great-great-grandmother, Shakeba, and she draws on her great-great-grandmother's strength, and she draws on the experiences that are narrated to her by her aunt.
In your novel, it seems that culturally, women's lives haven't changed all that much over the 100 years that separate these two characters. Rahima, whose story is set in modern-day Afghanistan, seems almost as hemmed in by decency rules as her great-great-grandmother was.
There's a big variation in Afghanistan in the time of Shakeba. That's about 100 years ago or a little bit more. They did not have a lot of rights. They did not enjoy a lot of freedoms, nor did women in other parts of the world at that time. And then there's a period of history that actually is missing in the book. It's those, you know, those generations that fall between these two stories, where in the major cities, especially in the capital, there was a big sweeping change that pushed women into another direction, where women were educated, where they were involved in the workplace. They were working as engineers, as physicians. They were traveling abroad for scholarships, doing all kinds of things. So it's a very different country than it was at that time. That being said, all of those changes didn't reach every corner of the country. So in some areas of the country, and especially in those outlying areas, the outskirts, far into villages, they did not reach those areas.
But like you say, maybe there has been a pendulum swing back to more kind of restrictive rules governing the lives of girls?
There clearly was during the more restrictive Taliban period. So a lot of the freedoms that they had were taken away. They were no longer going to pursue higher education. It meant that they couldn't wear the clothes that they would wear. They had to have longer sleeves on. You know, the burqa came about as a more routine matter of coded dress.
One of the characters in your book, Rahima, she is a short break from the rules that govern the lives of girls. Could you read a little bit from that part of your novel? It's on page 34, I think.
Sure. Madarjan took me behind the house with Pelerjan's scissors and razor. She pulled my long hair into a ponytail behind my head, whispered a prayer, and slowly began to shear away. Madarjan cut and trimmed, bended my ear forward to trim around it. She cut my bangs short and straight across my forehead. The next step was my clothing. Madarjan asked my uncle's wife for a shirt and a pair of pants. My cousin had outgrown them, as had his older brother and my other cousin before him. I slipped one leg in and then the other. They were slimmer and heavier than the usual balloon pants I wore under my dresses. I pulled the tunic over my head and realized there was no ponytail to pull through after it. I folded my arms across my chest and cocked my head as I'd seen my cousin Sadiq do so many times. I kicked my foot, pretending there was a ball in front of me. Was that it? Was I a boy already?
Great, thank you. So, what is a bachaposh?
A bachaposh literally translates into someone who is dressed as a boy. It's something that happens fairly routinely in Afghan culture.
When would a family decide to make a girl into a boy, essentially?
So families would do this for a few different reasons. Families that did not have a son were kind of lacking that honor, that, you know, that badge, that crest for the family, that one person that would carry on their name. The other reason that people would do it was born out of superstition. Some families believed that by dressing one of their girls as a boy, they actually could bring some good luck to the mother's womb, and then the mother would then have a child that would actually be born a son, a true son.
So for the girls living this way, at least in your novel, they really live as boys. They aren't subject to any of the rules that govern girls.
They're very much accepted as boys. For the families and the communities, they accept that young girl as a boy, and she travels and moves about society with all the rights and privileges that are usually afforded to a boy.
You mentioned that you've talked to different people who have known girls who lived as boys under this tradition. Do you have any sense of what the end is like for those girls when they go back to living as a woman when they hit puberty?
There's a big variety in the stories that I've heard and the people that I've spoken to, and then the interviews that I've read also. I know of one person who was dressed as a boy, and actually the fact that she was a girl was concealed from her father for about 9 years until she herself came to the realization that she was a girl and wanted to be restored as a girl. And that was done because the father was disappointed that he didn't have a son. And so the mother changed her to a boy to prevent the father from taking on a second wife. Other stories that I've read, it's given girls a sense of confidence. It's given them an entitlement that they did not have before. And a lot of them have gone on to be high-achieving people in society, and they've gone on to be deputy ministers or have government positions or becoming a nurse anesthetist. We wonder if that's because of their experience of living as a boy and because they were able to have that security and that ability to believe they deserve those positions, or would they have achieved those positions otherwise?
Hmm. In The Pearl That Broke Its Shell, Rahima, the character whose story takes place in contemporary Afghanistan, she gets to spend some time with female parliamentarians. And in one part of the book, one of those female parliamentarians is hurt in a car bomb. Rahima goes back home and she talks to her elderly aunt about the bombing. Could you read that section of the book?
I told her about everything, the hotel, the guards, the buildings, and the foreign soldiers. Then I told her about the bombing and the reason we came back. I heard about that on the radio. Bastards. Can't handle a woman with a voice. Is she going to come back to the parliament? She wants to. I didn't doubt that. Zamarod was not one to be scared off easily. I wished I could be more like her, so determined and brave. And I should be, I thought. I'd been so self-assured when I was a bachapush. Walking around with the boys, I feared nothing. If they had dared me to wrestle a grown man to the ground, I would have done it. I thought I could do anything. And now I trembled before my husband, before my mother-in-law. I had changed. I had lost my confidence. The dress I wore felt like a costume, something that disguised the confident, headstrong boy I was supposed to be. The dress, the husband, the mother-in-law, I wish I could toss them all aside.
Well, Nadia, you grew up in the United States, and you've said in other interviews that Afghan culture was kept alive in your home. Were there distinct gender roles in your family when you were growing up?
There were and there weren't. So I grew up with things like, you know, modest clothing. I wore T-shirts and shorts, but, you know, the shorts wouldn't be too short. You know, by Western standards, it was a little bit different. On the other hand, I was just thinking about this the other day. In my family, have never had any single male tell me that I couldn't do something. I never had anything but huge cheerleaders behind me. I have never once heard, you shouldn't do that because you're a girl. I have never once heard a restriction on what I could accomplish from any of the men in my family. And that, I think, was what really propelled me to look at what's happening to Afghan girls in Afghanistan now, because they don't have that experience. They don't have that support from the men around them.
And of course, you've accomplished a lot with that encouragement from your family. You're a novelist, of course, but also a pediatrician. You also have two children, and I believe a third one on the way. Is that right?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Very much on the way. Thank you.
Are any of your kids girls?
My middle child, or she will be the middle child shortly, she is a girl. She's the person who I've dedicated this book to. She has made me think very long and hard about what it means to be a girl and how I want to raise my daughter and what I want to teach her and the limits that I don't want to put on her. Having her has also changed the way I look at raising my son. We're very careful with the endearments that we use around the house. She's daddy's little scientist. She's not daddy's little princess, you know. And I enroll her in the same soccer camp that I enroll my son in. And we don't really channel their interests into those gender roles, as I want her to feel like the doors are open for whatever she wants to do.
Nadia Hashimi is the author of The Pearl That Broke Its Shell. She spoke with Sarah Nix. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show with help from Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Will Henkes. Special thanks to this week's audio guru, Joe Hartke. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks to you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.